This is disc number 8.
Gabriel resumed his pacing. 2 minutes later, the telephone rang again. He snatched up the receiver and brought it quickly to his ear. Ishak, he said with an artificial brightness. I'm glad you called. I assume we have a deal.
We do. As long as you agree to my one condition.
You're not in much of a position to make demands, Ishak.
Neither are you.
What's your condition?
I'll give her to my father, but no one else.
That's not necessary, Ishak. Just stop the car and leave Elizabeth by the side of the road, somewhere safe and dry, somewhere out of harm's way. Then drive away. It doesn't need to be any more complicated than that.
I need proof my father is still in Europe.
A pause.
I need proof he's still alive.
Your father is a founding member of the Sword of Allah, Ishak. Your father isn't going to go anywhere near my girl.
My father is an innocent man. And unless he's there, you don't get your girl.
Gabriel looked at Carter, who nodded his head. All right, Ishak. You win. We'll do it your way. Just tell me where you want to do it.
Are you in Denmark?
I told you, Ishak, it doesn't matter where I am.
It matters to me.
Yes, Ishak. I'm in Denmark. Let's just do it here, shall we? It's a small country, lots of open spaces, and the Danish police are willing to let you be on your way after you release Elizabeth.
I need a guarantee of safe passage over the border. No checkpoints. No roadblocks. If a policeman so much as looks at me twice, the woman is dead. Do you understand?
I understand. We'll tell the local authorities to stand down. No one is going to bother you. Just tell me how you want to do it.
I'll call you tomorrow and tell you what to do.
Tomorrow? That's not good enough, Ishak.
If tomorrow isn't good enough, then your girl dies tonight.
Another glance at Carter. Another nod of the head. All right, Ishak. What time are you going to call me tomorrow?
I'll call at noon, Copenhagen time.
Too long, Ishak. I want to hear from you much sooner than that.
It's noon or nothing. It's your choice.
All right. Noon it is. Don't disappoint me. The line went dead. Gabriel hung up the phone and buried his face in his hands. I gave him room to maneuver, Adrian, just like Washington wanted, and he maneuvered me right into a corner. We'll wait until tomorrow and listen to what he has to say. And what if we don't like what he has to say? Then we won't accept the deal. No, Adrian. We'll do exactly what he tells us to do. Because if we don't, he's going to kill her. Chapter 37. Their security had been exceptionally good. They never entered her cell without their faces covered, and not once since the initial seconds of her capture had they spoken a single word to her. They had permitted her no newspapers or reading material of any kind, and a request for a radio to help pass the empty hours had been met by a slow shake of Kane's head. She had lost track of how long she had been in captivity. She had no idea whether the rest of the world thought she was alive or dead, nor did she have any clues as to her whereabouts. She might still be in the east of England, she thought, or she might be in a cave complex in Tora Bora. Of one thing, however, she was certain. Her captors were moving her on a regular basis. The proof of the movement was plain for her to see. The rooms where she was being held were all variations of the first. White walls, a camp bed, a single lamp, a door with a spy hole. But each was clearly different. She would have been able to discern this even if they had forced her to wear a blindfold, because her senses of smell and hearing were now heightened to an animal acuteness. She could hear them coming long before they slid the notes beneath her door, and now could distinguish Cain from Abel by scent alone. Her last cell had stunk of liquid bleach. The one where she was being held now was filled with the pleasant aroma of coffee and Middle Eastern spices. She was in a market, she thought, or perhaps the warehouse of a distributor that supplied grocers in Arab neighborhoods. Her heightened senses had allowed her to gather one other piece of information. There was a distinct rhythm to her movements. This rhythm was not measured by hours and minutes. Time, for all her attempts to capture it, remained a mystery to her. But in the number of meals she was given in each location, it was always the same. 4 meals of identical content, then a shot of ketamine. Then she would awaken in a new room with new smells. Thus far, she had been given 3 meals in her current location. Her 4th would be coming soon. Elizabeth knew that, in all likelihood, it would be followed several hours later by an injection of ketamine. She would struggle, but her struggle would quickly turn to submission in the face of greater strength than numbers. Submission. That was their goal. Submission was the overall goal of the global jihadists, and it was the goal of Elizabeth's captors as well. The global jihadists wanted the West to submit to the will of violent Salafist Islam. Elizabeth's captors wanted her to submit to the needle and the mind-numbing rhythm of their movements and their notes. They wanted her weak and compliant, a sheep that offers its throat willingly to the ritual knife. Elizabeth had decided that her days of submission were over. She had decided to stage a rebellion she hoped would provide her with information as to her whereabouts, a rebellion fought with the only 2 weapons available to her own life and her knowledge of medicine. She closed her eyes and inhaled the pleasant aroma of coffee and cinnamon, and she waited for Cain to open the door and present her with her 4th meal. Chapter 38. Copenhagen, 2:52 p.m., Thursday.
"So, it comes down to the 2 of us once again," Ibrahim said. "I suppose that's fitting."
Gabriel cleared the windshield of his Audi A8 sedan with a flick of the wiper blades. The King's New Square appeared before him, shrouded in a bridal veil of snowfall. Ibrahim was sitting silently in the passenger seat, freshly scrubbed and dressed for his own funeral in a borrowed gray suit and overcoat. His hands were folded primly in his lap, good hand atop ruined hand, and his eyes were on his shoes. Gabriel's telephone lay in the console. Its signal was being monitored inside the CIA station at the American Embassy and at NSA headquarters.
"You're not going to give me another one of your lectures, are you, Ibrahim?" "I am still a professor at heart," he said. "I can't help it."
Gabriel decided to indulge him. A lecture was better than silence.
"Why do you suppose it's fitting?"
"We have both seen the worst this life has to offer. Nothing can frighten us, and nothing that happens today will surprise us."
He looked up from his shoes and gazed at Gabriel for a moment.
"The things they wrote about you in the newspapers after London. It was all true? You were the one who killed the members of Black September?"
Ibrahim interpreted Gabriel's silence as affirmation. The newspaper accounts were all true.
"I remember Munich so clearly," Ibrahim said. "We spent that day standing around our televisions and radios. It electrified the Arab world. We cheered the capture of your athletes, and when they were massacred at the airport, we danced in the streets. In retrospect, our reaction was appalling, but completely understandable. We were weak and humiliated. You were strong and rich. You had beaten us many times. We had finally beaten you in Germany, of all places, land of your greatest catastrophe.
I thought you Islamists didn't believe in the Holocaust. I thought you regarded it as a great lie, foisted upon the world by clever Jews so we could rob the Arabs of their land."
"I've never been one to dabble in self-delusion and conspiracy theory," Ibrahim said. "You Jews deserve a national home. God knows you need one. But the sooner you give the Palestinians a state in the West Bank and Gaza, the better for all of us."
"And if that means giving it to your spiritual brethren in Hamas?"
"At the rate we're going, Hamas will look like moderates soon," Ibrahim said. "And when the Palestinian issue is finally removed from the table, the Arabs will have no one else to blame for their miserable condition. We will be forced to take a hard look in the mirror and solve our problems for ourselves."
"That's just one of the reasons why there will never be peace. We're the scapegoat for Arab failings, the pressure valve for Arab unrest. The Arabs loathe us, but they cannot live without us."
Ibrahim nodded in agreement and resumed the study of his shoes.
"Is it also true that you are a famous art restorer?"
This time Gabriel nodded slowly. Ibrahim pulled his lips into an incredulous frown.
"Why, if you have the ability to heal beautiful paintings, do you engage in work such as this?"
"Duty,"
said Gabriel. I feel an obligation to protect my people.
The terrorists would say the same thing.
Perhaps, but I don't murder the innocent.
You just threatened to send them to Egypt to be tortured.
Ibrahim looked at Gabriel.
Would you have done it?
Gabriel shook his head. No, Ibrahim. I wouldn't have sent you back. Ibrahim looked out his window.
The snow is beautiful, he said.
Is it a good omen or bad? A friend of mine calls weather like this operational weather.
That's good.
Gabriel nodded.
It's good. You've done this kind of thing before?
Only once.
How did it end?
With the Gare de Lyon in rubble, thought Gabriel. I got the hostage back, he said.
The street that he wants us to walk down.
Do you know it? Gabriel lifted his hand from the wheel and pointed across the square. It's called Stryette. It's a pedestrian mall lined with shops and restaurants, 2 miles long, the longest in Europe, if the hotel brochures are to be believed. It empties into a square called the Radusplatzen.
We walk, and they watch. Is that how it works?
That's exactly how it works. And if they like what they see, someone will phone me when we reach the Radusplatzen and tell me where to go next.
When do we start?
3 o'clock.
3 o'clock, Ibrahim repeated. The hour of death. At least, that's what the Christians believe. Why do you think they chose 3 o'clock?
It gives them a few minutes of daylight to see us properly in Stryette. After that, it will be dark. That gives them the advantage. It makes it harder for me to see them.
What about your little helpers?
Ibrahim asked. The ones who plucked me from that street corner in Amsterdam. Ishak says if he detects surveillance, the deal is off and Elizabeth Halton dies.
So we go alone.
Gabriel nodded and looked at his watch. It was 2:59. It's not too late to back out, you know. You don't have to do this.
I made you a promise in that house 2 nights ago. A promise that I would help you get the American woman back. It is a promise I intend to keep.
He squeezed his face into a quizzical frown.
Where were we, by the way?
We were in Germany.
A Jew threatening to torture an Arab in Germany,
Ibrahim replied. How poetic.
You're not going to give me another one of your lectures, are you, Ibrahim?
I'm inclined to, but I'm afraid there isn't time. He pointed to the dashboard clock.
The hour of death is upon us.
The atmosphere along Stryette was one of feverish festivity. To Gabriel, it seemed like the last night before the start of a long-feared war, the night when fortunes are spent and love is made with headlong abandon. But there was no war coming, at least not for the shoppers along Copenhagen's most famous street, only the holidays. Gabriel had been so absorbed in the search for Elizabeth Halton, he had forgotten it was nearly Christmas. They drifted through this joyous streetscape like detached spirits of the dead, hands thrust into coat pockets, elbows touching, silent. Ishak had decreed that their journey would be a straight line and would include no stops. That meant that Gabriel was unable to conduct even the most basic counter-surveillance maneuvers. It had been more than 30 years since he had walked a European street without checking his tail, and to do so now made him feel as though he were trapped in one of those anxiety dreams where he was naked in a world of the fully clothed. He saw enemies everywhere, old and new. He saw men who might be sort-of-a-law terrorists, and men who might be Danish security. And, in the shelter of a storefront, he swore he saw Eli Levon playing Christmas carols on a violin. It wasn't Levon, only his doppelganger. Besides, Gabriel remembered suddenly, Levon couldn't play the violin. Levon, for all his gifts, had an ear of stone. They paused for the first time at the intersection of a cross street and waited for the light to change. A Bengali man pressed a flyer into Gabriel's palm with such urgency that Gabriel nearly drew his Beretta from his coat pocket. The flyer was for a restaurant near the Tivoli Gardens. Gabriel read it carefully to make sure it contained no hidden instructions, then crushed it into a ball and dropped it into a rubbish bin. The light turned green. He hooked Ibrahim by the elbow and walked on. It was beginning to grow dark now.
The street lamps were burning more brightly, and the lights in the shop windows glowed with a greeting card warmth. Gabriel had given up on trying to find the watchers, and instead found himself gazing in wonder at the scenes around him, at children eating ice cream despite the falling snow, at the pretty young woman kneeling over the contents of a spilled shopping bag, at carolers dressed like elves singing about the birth of God with voices of angels. He remembered the words Uzi Naboth had spoken that first night, as they drove through the hills outside Jerusalem. The Europeans condemned us for Lebanon, but what they don't understand is that Lebanon is merely a preview of coming attractions. The movie will soon be showing in theaters all across Europe. Gabriel only hoped it wasn't coming to Copenhagen tonight. They paused at another crosswalk, then struck out across the vast Rathausplatzen. On the left side of the square stood City Hall, the spire of its clock tower jutting knife-like into a low cloud. In the center of the square was a brightly lit Yuletide tree, 50 feet in height, and, next to the tree, a small kiosk selling sausages and hot cider. Gabriel walked over to the kiosk and joined the queue, but before he reached the service window, the phone in his coat pocket rang softly. He brought it to his ear and listened without speaking. A few seconds later, he returned the phone to his pocket and took Ibrahim by the elbow.
"They want us to retrace our steps and go back to the car," Gabriel said as they walked across the square.
"Then what?"
"They didn't say.
What are we going to do?"
"We're going to do what they tell us to do."
"Do they know what they're doing?"
Gabriel nodded. They knew exactly what they were doing. The Audi was where he had left it, and was now covered with a dusting of fresh snow. Sarah was seated alone in the window of a nearby cafe. She was wearing her beret, and it was tilted slightly to the left, which meant that the car had not been tampered with in their absence. Even so, Gabriel dropped his keys onto the paving stones and gave the undercarriage a quick inspection before opening the door and climbing in. The telephone rang immediately after Ibrahim joined him. Gabriel listened to the instructions, then severed the connection and started the engine. He looked once more into the cafe window and saw that Sarah had lifted her hand into the air. He feared that she was waving goodbye to him in blatant contravention of all known tradecraft, but a few seconds later a waiter appeared and deposited a check at her elbow. Sarah placed a few bills onto the table and stood. Gabriel slipped the car into gear and eased away from the curb.
"Take your time," Ishak had said. "We have a long night ahead of us."
Chapter 39. The note appeared beneath her door. She swung her shackled feet to the floor and shuffled slowly across her cell. It was Cain who stood on the other side awaiting her reply. She could smell him. The note said, "Do you want food?"
"Yes," she replied in a low, evenly modulated voice.
Then, like a model prisoner, she lay down on her cot again and waited for him to come inside. She heard the sound of a key being shoved into a padlock, followed by the groaning of hinges. This door was louder than the door of her last cell, and the sound of it opening always set her teeth on edge. Cain placed the food at the foot of her cot and quickly withdrew. Elizabeth sat up again and scrutinized the meal. A few inches of baguette, a lump of cheese of indeterminate origin, a bottle of Evian water, chocolate, because she had been good. She devoured the food and gulped the water. Then, when she was certain no one was watching through the spy hole, she shoved her fingers down her throat and vomited her fourth meal onto the floor of her cell. Cain burst in 2 minutes later and glared at her angrily. Her blanket was now wrapped around her shoulders and she appeared to be shivering uncontrollably.
"The ketamine," she whispered. "You're killing me with the ketamine."
Abel brought a bucket of water and a rag and made her clean her own vomit. Only when her cell was cleansed of impure female excretions did Cain appear. He stood as far from her as possible, as though he feared catching whatever was ailing her, and with a terse movement of his hand, invited her to explain her affliction.
"Idiopathic paroxysmal ventricular tachycardia."
She paused for a moment and drew a series of rapid, heavy breaths.
"It is a fancy way of saying that I suffer from sporadic arrhythmia in the lower chambers of my heart, the ventricles. This sporadic arrhythmia has been exacerbated by too many injections of ketamine. My heartbeat is now dangerously rapid and arrhythmic, and my blood pressure is extremely low, which is causing the nausea and the chills. If you give me another shot of ketamine, you could very well kill me.
He stood silently for a moment, gazing at her through the eye slits of his hood, then withdrew. Several minutes later, about 20, she guessed, but she couldn't be sure, he returned and handed her a typewritten note. For reasons we cannot explain to you, it is necessary for you to be moved this evening. If you are conscious during this movement, you will be extremely uncomfortable. Do you want the ketamine, or do you want to be moved while you are awake?
No more ketamine, she said. I'll do it conscious.
Kane looked at her as though she had made the wrong choice, then handed her a second note. If you scream or make any noise whatsoever, we will kill you and leave you by the side of the road.
I understand, she said.
Kane collected the two notes and slipped out of her cell. Elizabeth stretched out on her cot and stared into the blinding white light. Her rebellion was only a few minutes old, but already she had managed to gather two small pieces of information. She was to be moved by road and at night. When next they entered her cell, they did so without first alerting her with a note. They bound her quickly in her own woolen blanket and secured it to her body cocoon-like with heavy packing tape. Foam rubber plugs were inserted into her ears, a gag placed over her mouth, and a blindfold tied tightly over her eyes. Now robbed of all senses but touch and smell, she felt them take hold of her body, one at each end, and carry her a short distance. The container into which she was placed was so narrow that the sides pressed hard against her hips and shoulders. It smelled of plywood and glue, and vaguely of old fish. A lid was placed over the top, so close that it nearly touched the end of her nose, and several nails were hurriedly hammered into place. She wanted to scream. She did not. She wanted to cry out for her mother. She prayed silently instead, and thought of the slender man with gray temples who had tried to save her life in Hyde Park. I will not submit, she thought. I will not submit. Chapter 40. Funen Island, Denmark, 8:35 p.m., Thursday. The lights of the Great Belt Bridge, second longest suspension bridge in the world, lay like a double strand of pearls over the straits between the Danish islands of Zealand and Funen. Gabriel glanced at the dashboard clock as he headed up the long sweep of the eastern ramp. The trip from Copenhagen to this point should have taken no more than 2 hours, but the worsening storm had stretched it to nearly four. He returned his eyes to the road and put both hands firmly on the wheel. The bridge was swaying in the high winds. Ibrahim asked again if the weather was truly a good omen. Gabriel replied that he hoped Ibrahim knew how to swim. It took them 20 minutes to make the 8-mile crossing. On the Funen side of the bridge, a small seaside rail station lay huddled against the storm. A mile beyond the station was a roadside gas station and café. Gabriel topped off the Audi's tank, then parked outside the café and led Ibrahim inside. It was brilliantly lit, smartly decorated, and spotlessly clean. In the first room was a well-stocked market and cafeteria-style eatery. In the next was a seating area filled with stranded travelers. There was much animated conversation, and, judging from the large number of empty Carlsberg bottles scattered about the pale wooden tables, considerable drinking had taken place. They bought egg sandwiches and hot tea in the cafeteria and sat at an empty table near the window. Ibrahim ate silently, while Gabriel sipped his tea and stared out at the car. 30 minutes elapsed before the cell phone finally rang. Gabriel brought it to his ear, listened without speaking, then severed the connection. "Wait here," he said. He stopped briefly in the men's toilet, where he buried his Beretta and phone in the rubbish bin, then went into the market and purchased a large-scale map of Denmark and an English-language tourist guide. When he returned to the dining room, Ibrahim was in the process of unwrapping the second egg sandwich. Ibrahim slipped it into his coat pocket and followed Gabriel outside.
"Here it is," said Ibrahim. "Lindholm Høje.
He was hunched over the guidebook, reading it by the light of the overhead lamp. Gabriel kept his eyes fastened to the road.
What does it say?
It's an old Viking village and cemetery. For centuries it was buried beneath a thick layer of sand. It only was discovered in 1952. According to the book, it has more than 700 graves and the remains of a few Viking longhouses.
Where is it?
Ibrahim consulted the book again, then plotted the position of the site on the road map.
Northern Jutland, he said. Very northern Jutland, actually.
How do I get there?
Take the E-20 across Funen, then head north on the E-45. Lindholm is just after Aalborg. The book says it's easy to find the place. Just follow the signs.
I can't see the road, let alone the signs.
Is that where they're going to leave the woman?
Gabriel shook his head.
More instructions. This time they'll be written. They say they'll be in the ruins of the longhouse, in the corner farthest from the museum entrance.
He looked briefly at Ibrahim.
It wasn't Ishak this time.
It was someone else. Egyptian.
He sounded Egyptian to me, but I'm no expert.
Please, said Ibrahim dismissively. Why did they make you get rid of your telephone?
No more electronic communication.
Ibrahim looked down at the map.
It's a long way from here to Lindholm.
2 hours in perfect weather. In this, 4 at least.
Ibrahim looked at the clock.
That means it will be Friday morning, if we're lucky.
Yes, said Gabriel. He's running us up against the deadline.
Who? Ishak?
A very good question, thought Gabriel. Was it Ishak, or was it the Sphinx? It took 4.5 hours to reach Lindholm, and, just as Gabriel had feared, the guidebook's assurances that the cemetery was easy to find turned out to be false. He drove in circles for 20 minutes through a neighborhood of matching brick houses before finally spotting a postcard-sized sign he had missed 3 times previously. It was obscured by snow, of course. Gabriel had to climb out of the Audi and brush away the flakes, only to learn that in order to reach the site, he had to first scale a formidable hill. The Audi handled the conditions with only a single episode of fishtailing, and 2 minutes later, Gabriel was easing into a car park surrounded by towering pine. He shut down the engine and sat for a moment, his ears ringing from the strain of the drive, before finally opening the door and putting a foot into the snow. Ibrahim stayed where he was.
You're not coming?
I'll wait here, if you don't mind.
Don't tell me you're afraid of cemeteries.
No, just Viking cemeteries.
They were only warlike when they took to the seas,
Gabriel said. Here at home, they were largely an agrarian people. The scariest thing we're likely to run across tonight is the ghost of a vegetable farmer. If it's all the same to you, I'll just stay here.
Suit yourself, Gabriel said.
If you want to sit here alone, that's fine with me.
Ibrahim made a show of thought, then climbed out. Gabriel opened the trunk and removed the flashlight and the tire iron.
Why are you bringing that? Asked Ibrahim.
In case we come across any Vikings.
He slipped the tool down the front of his jeans and quietly closed the trunk.
They made me leave my gun back at that service station, too. A crowbar is better than nothing.
Gabriel switched on the flashlight and set out across the car park with Ibrahim at his side. The snow was 6 inches deep, and within a few steps, Gabriel's brogans were sodden and his feet freezing. 30 seconds after leaving the car, he stopped suddenly. There were 2 sets of faint tracks in the snow, one set obviously larger than the other, leading from the car park into the burial ground. Gabriel left Ibrahim alone and followed the footprints back to their point of origin. Judging from the condition of the snow's surface, it appeared as though a small truck or transit van had entered the lot from a second access road several hours earlier. The larger of the 2 occupants had stepped into the snow from the driver's side of the vehicle, the smaller from the passenger's side. Gabriel crouched in the snow and scrutinized the smaller prints as though he were examining brush strokes on a canvas. The prints were feminine, he decided, and whoever had left them had been wearing athletic shoes. There was no evidence of any struggle. Gabriel rejoined Ibrahim and led him down a footpath into the site. The cemetery fell away before them, down the slope of the hill toward a vast inland bay in the distance. Despite the snowfall, it was possible to discern, in the glow of Gabriel's flashlight, the outlines of individual graves. Some were mounds of stones, some were circles, and still others were shaped like Viking ships. It was not difficult to find the far corner of the longhouse. All Gabriel had to do was follow the twin sets of tracks. He crouched down and probed with his bare hands beneath the surface of the snow. A few seconds later, he found what had been left there for him. A small plastic Ziploc bag containing a portion of a detailed map. He examined it by the glow of his flashlight. Then he stood and led Ibrahim back to the car.
Skagen, said Gabriel as he drove slowly down the hill. They want us to go to Skagen.
Well, almost to Skagen. The spot they circled on the map is a little to the south.
You know this place?
I've never been there, but I know it. There was an artist colony that formed there in the late 1800s. They were known as the Skagen School of Painters. They came there for the light. They say it's unique. Not that we'll be seeing any of it.
Perhaps this is another good omen, said Ibrahim.
Perhaps, said Gabriel.
Will the ambassador's daughter be there?
It doesn't say. It just tells us to go to a spot along the North Sea.
Was she in the burial ground tonight?
They wanted me to think she was, Gabriel said. But I don't believe she was there.
How can you tell?
Because the woman got out of the vehicle and walked into the cemetery on her own, Gabriel said. I saw Elizabeth at the moment of her abduction. She wouldn't have walked in there on her own. She would have fought them.
Unless they told her she was about to be released, said Ibrahim.
Gabriel gave him an admiring sideways glance.
You're not bad, he said.
I was a professor once, he said, and I love detective novels.
Chapter 41. She did not know the duration of her journey, for she had tried to think of anything but the clock. It was but a few minutes, she told herself. It was the blink of an eye. She had told herself other lies as well. She was in a comfortable bed, not a wooden box that smelled faintly of fish. She was wearing faded blue jeans and her favorite sweater, not the same dirty tracksuit she had been wearing since the morning of her capture. She could see her favorite mountain range through her favorite window. She was listening to beautiful music. The rest were just scenes from a bad dream. She would wake soon, and it would all be over. She had been prepared for the appalling discomfort. Kane's note had made it abundantly clear what lay in store for her. But the earplugs had taken her by surprise. They had robbed her of one of her most potent weapons, the ability to hear what was taking place around her, and had reduced her world to a monotonous droning. She had been left with only one sense, the ability to feel motion. She knew that they had driven at high speeds and at moderate speeds, on good roads and bad. Once, she'd had the sensation of being in a large city surrounded by people who did not realize she was only inches away. Now she felt certain they were on an unpaved track, in a place near the end of the earth. They stopped suddenly, so suddenly that her head was pressed painfully against the end of her coffin-like container, and a moment later the droning of the engine went silent. Several minutes elapsed before they finally removed her from the vehicle, and several more passed before she finally heard the screech of the nails being removed by the claw of a hammer. Cold, salty air streamed over her face as the lid came off. Hot tears spilled involuntarily into the fabric of her blindfold as she was lifted to her feet. No one spoke to her as she was led inside the new hideout. No one asked about the condition of her arrhythmic heart as she was placed on the cot in her new cell. When the door closed on her again, she removed the blindfold and the earplugs and gazed at a new set of white walls. There was a plate of food, bread, cheese, and chocolate because she had been good during the drive, and there was a yellow bucket for her toilet. She had no idea where they had moved her, but was certain of one thing. She could smell the sea. Chapter 42. Condestedern, Denmark. 2:15 a.m., Friday. The road from the Baltic port of Frederikshavn to Skagen was abandoned and barely passable. Gabriel sat hunched over the steering wheel for mile after mile as a string of silent snowbound towns flashed past.
Their names were full of strange consonant combinations that even Gabriel, whose first language was German, found impenetrable. Danish is not a language, he thought resentfully as he plunged through the gloom. Danish is merely an affliction of the throat. After leaving the town of Aalborg, a seemingly endless moonscape of dunes opened before them. The cutoff toward the summer resort town of Condestadern lay near the northern end of the wasteland. Gabriel, after making the turn, saw a single set of freshly made tire tracks in the snow. He suspected they had been left by the same vehicle that had been at the cemetery in Lindholm-Hoye. They sledded past a few small farms, then entered another expanse of dunes, vast dunes this time, dunes the size of foothills. Here and there, Gabriel glimpsed the outlines of cottages and small homes. There were no lights burning, no other cars, and no other signs of life. Time, it seemed, had stopped. The tire tracks bent to the right, into a narrow road, and vanished behind a curtain of snowfall. Gabriel continued straight and stopped a moment later at a small car park overlooking the beach, next to a boarded-up cafe. He started to switch off the engine, then thought better of it. "Wait here," he said. "Lock the doors after I get out. Don't open them for anyone but me." He took the tire tool and flashlight and walked over to the cafe. There were fresh footprints all around, two sets at least, perhaps more. Whoever had left them had come to this spot from the dunes. One set of tracks led down to the beach. They were identical to the ones he had seen at Lindholm, the woman's. He glanced back toward the Audi, then turned and followed the tracks across the beach. At the water's edge, they disappeared. He looked left, then right, but could see no sign of them, so he turned around and headed back to the car. As he drew near, he could see that Ibrahim was leaning forward awkwardly and had his palms pressed to the dashboard. Then he saw a set of fresh tracks leading from the dunes to the rear passenger side door of the Audi. Just then, the window slid down halfway, and a gloved hand beckoned him forward. Gabriel hesitated for a few seconds, then obeyed. Along the way, he made a slight detour in order to examine the prints. Size 6, he reckoned. Adidas or Nike. A woman's shoe. He had been wrong about the brand of the shoes. They were Pumas. The woman who was wearing them looked no older than 25. She wore a navy blue peacoat and a wool hat pulled down close to her dark eyes. She was seated directly behind Ibrahim and had a Makarov pointed at his spine. Her hand was vibrating with cold. "Why don't you point that gun at the floor before someone gets hurt?" Gabriel said. "Shut up and put your hands on the steering wheel." She spoke very calmly. Gabriel did as he was told. "Where's Ishak?"
"Ishak who?" she asked.
"Let's not play any more games. It's been a long, cold night." He looked at her in the rearview mirror. "Just tell us where we can find Elizabeth Halton, and we'll be on our way."
"You are the Israeli, yes? The Zionist pig who killed our comrades in Hyde Park?"
"No, I'm an American pig."
"You speak very good Arabic for an American pig."
"My father was a diplomat. I grew up in Beirut."
"Really? Then speak English for me, American pig."
Gabriel hesitated. The girl leveled the gun at the back of Ibrahim's head. "You've made your point," Gabriel said. She pointed the gun at Gabriel.
"I should kill you now," she said. "But you're fortunate. You won't be dying tonight. Others have already laid claim to your life."
"Lucky me." She hit him in the back of the head with the gun, hard enough for Gabriel to see a burst of fireworks before his eyes. When he reached reflexively toward the wound, she hit him again, harder still, and commanded him to put his hands back on the wheel. A moment later, he could feel something warm and sticky running along the back of his right ear.
"Feel better?"
he asked.
"Yes,"
she said sincerely.
"Let's get this over with, shall we?" "Turn the car around," the woman said. "Slowly."
Gabriel eased the car into gear, executed a careful three-point turn, and headed inland.
"Make the first left into the dunes," the woman said. "Then follow the tire tracks."
He did as she instructed. The road was wide enough for only a single car, and led to a colony of cottages tucked within the dunes. The cottages were small and wooden, and abandoned to the winter. Some were painted Skagen yellow. Others, inexplicably, had grass growing on the roof. Gabriel navigated only by the amber light of the parking lamps. The blood was now running freely down the side of his neck, into his shirt collar. He followed the tracks up a small, humpbacked hill, then plunged down the other side and saw another knoll ahead. Fearful of becoming lodged in the snow, he kept his foot on the gas and heard a loud crunching sound when the car ran aground at the bottom of the dip. He gunned it hard up the next hill and swerved to the left, then glided down the other side into the drive of the farthest cottage. A silver LDV Maxus transit van was parked outside, lights doused. Gabriel came to a stop and looked into the rearview mirror for instructions. The woman jabbed Ibrahim in the back with the barrel of the Makarov and told him to open the door. When Gabriel reached for his own latch, she hit him in the back of the head for a third time.
"You stay here in the car," she snapped. "We'll give the woman only to Ibrahim, not you, Zionist pig."
Ibrahim unclasped his safety belt and opened the door. The overhead light burst suddenly on. Gabriel put a hand atop Ibrahim's forearm and squeezed.
"Don't go," he said. "Stay in the car."
Ibrahim looked at him incredulously.
"What are you talking about, my friend? We've come all this way."
"It was all just a game to run out the clock. She's not here. Your son has lured you here in order to kill you."
"Why would my son kill me?"
"Because you betrayed him to the Crusaders and the Jews," Gabriel said. "Because he is a Takfiri Muslim, and, in his eyes, you are now an apostate worthy only of death. You are worse than a Crusader, even worse than a Jew, because you were once a devout Islamist who has now renounced the path of jihad. The woman is taking you inside to be killed, Ibrahim. Don't go with her."
"My son would never harm me."
"He's not your son anymore." Ibrahim smiled and removed Gabriel's hand from his arm.
"You must have faith, my friend. Let me go. I'll bring the girl out to you, just as I promised."
Gabriel felt the barrel of the Makarov pressing against the base of his skull.
"Listen to Ibrahim, Zionist pig. He speaks the truth. We do not kill our parents. You are the murderers, not us. Let him bring you the girl so you can be on your way."
Ibrahim climbed out of the car before Gabriel could stop him and started toward the cottage. The woman waited until he was several yards away before lowering the gun from Gabriel's head and setting off after him. As they neared the entrance, a man appeared in the doorway. In the snow and darkness, Gabriel could discern little of his appearance, only that his hair had been dyed platinum blonde. He greeted Ibrahim formally, with kisses on both cheeks and a hand reverentially over his heart, and led him inside. Then the woman closed the door, and the windshield exploded in Gabriel's face. Part 4. The Bridge Over Jahannam. Chapter 43. Winfield House, London, 7:05 a.m., Friday. It would be nearly an hour before word of the disaster in northern Denmark reached Washington, and another 30 minutes would elapse before the first news reached Winfield House, the official residence of the American ambassador to the United Kingdom. Despite the lateness of the hour, it was 3:15 a.m. in London and 10:15 p.m. in Washington. Robert Halton was seated at the desk in his private study, where he had remained throughout that long night, waiting for word from the White House Situation Room. Though he had been expecting a call for many hours, the sound of the ringing telephone caused him to recoil involuntarily, as though from a nearby gunshot. As he snatched the receiver from the cradle, he thought for an instant that he could hear the sound of Elizabeth weeping. It must have been a burst of interference on the line, or a hallucination, he would think later, for the voice he heard when he brought the phone to his ear belonged not to his daughter, but to Cyrus Mansfield, the President's National Security Advisor. Halton could tell from Mansfield's guarded greeting that the news from Denmark was not what he had been praying for, though nothing could have prepared him for what was relayed to him next. Gabriel Allon and his Egyptian asset had been led from Copenhagen to the tip of Denmark, said Mansfield. There had been an incident of some sort at an isolated cottage on the North Sea, the details of which were still unclear. There had been an explosion. There were at least 3 known deaths. Until additional resources arrived on the scene, including Danish forensics teams, it would be impossible to know whether Elizabeth was among those killed. For the remainder of that night, Robert Halton was cast into a new kind of hell. Cyrus Mansfield called with a maddening regularity, even when there was little new or vital to report. As is common in situations such as these, much of the information was contradictory and later proven wrong. Halton was told there were 3 bodies in the house. Then, 30 minutes later, was informed that there were 4. There was evidence Elizabeth had been in Denmark, said Mansfield. There was speculation she might still be there. There had been gunfire. Alon had been gravely wounded. Alon had been killed. Finally, at 7.05 a.m., London time, as a gray dawn was breaking over Regent's Park, the President telephoned to say that Danish fire and rescue had found just 3 bodies in the charred ruins of the residence. According to a statement from Gabriel Alon, who was injured but very much alive, the dead consisted of 2 terrorists, 1 male and 1 female, and the Egyptian asset Ibrahim Fawaz. The National Security Council, the FBI, the CIA, and the State Department were all operating under the assumption that Elizabeth was still alive, and frantic efforts to secure her release would continue until the deadline and beyond. Robert Halton hung up the phone and fell to his knees in a desperate prayer of thanksgiving. Then he stumbled into his bathroom and was violently sick. He lay for several minutes on the cold marble floor, his body seemingly paralyzed by anguish and grief. "Where are you, Robert Halton?" he thought. Where was the business maverick who had turned a small oil exploration company into a global energy conglomerate? Where was the man who, for the sake of his daughter, had stoically endured the loss of his beloved wife? Where was the man who, against all odds, had managed to put his best friend in the White House? He was gone, thought Halton. He had been kidnapped by the terrorists, just as surely as Elizabeth had been. He rose to his feet and rinsed his mouth in the sink, then stepped from the bathroom and returned to his office. It was now Friday morning. By nightfall, his daughter would be dead. Robert Carlyle Halton, billionaire and kingmaker, had watched helplessly while the combined forces of American intelligence, diplomacy, and law enforcement, along with their counterparts across Europe and the Middle East, had searched in vain for his daughter. He had stood idly by and listened to their empty assurances that eventually Elizabeth would be brought home to him alive. He was prepared to stand idly by no longer. He would now deploy the only weapon available to him, a weapon even the jihadists understood. The course of action he was about to undertake bordered on treason, for, if successful, Halton would be providing the terrorists a weapon they could later use against the United States and its allies. But if treason was necessary to save his daughter, then Robert Halton was prepared to be a traitor, if only for a few hours. He walked calmly to his desk and sat down before the computer, imagining for a moment that he was no longer a helpless and grief-stricken father, but once again a steady and assured CEO and magnate. A click of the mouse brought a letter onto the screen. It had been composed by Halton during the first week of the crisis and saved for this very moment. His eyes scanned the arid prose. "Due to present circumstances, unable to continue in my role as your ambassador in London, an honor and pleasure to serve, Robert Carlyle Halton." He added the proper date, clicked the print icon, and watched the letter slide onto his desk. After adding his signature, he loaded the letter into his fax machine. He did not send it just yet. The CEO had a few more deals to close. He picked up the telephone and dialed a local London number. The number was located inside No. 10 Downing Street, the official residence of the British Prime Minister, and was answered instantly by Oliver Gibbons, the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff. Halton and Gibbons had spoken several times during the past 2 weeks, and there was no need for formalities. Halton said he needed to speak to the Prime Minister urgently. Gibbons responded by saying that the Prime Minister was in a breakfast meeting and would not be free for another 20 minutes. The meeting apparently ended sooner than anticipated, because 12 minutes later, the Prime Minister returned the call. "I'm about to try something desperate," Halton said, "and I want to know whether I can count on you and your authorities to make it happen." The conversation that ensued next was brief,
Later, at the official inquest, much would be made of the fact it was just 6 minutes in length, and concluded with a promise by the Prime Minister that the police and intelligence services of Britain would do anything necessary to help Halton in his endeavor. Halton thanked the Prime Minister, then dialed a number in his own embassy. It was answered by Stephen Barnes, the Deputy Public Affairs Officer. His boss, Jack Hammond, had been killed in Hyde Park the morning of Elizabeth's abduction. Barnes had been given a field promotion of sorts, and had served ably as the embassy's chief spokesman throughout the crisis.
"I need to make a statement to the press, Steve. I'd like to do it here at Winfield House instead of the embassy. It will be important. The networks need to know that they should carry it live and in its entirety, especially the European networks and the Arab satellite channels."
"What time?"
"Noon should be fine. Can you arrange it by then?"
"No problem,"
Barnes said.
"Is there anything I can draft for you?"
"No. I can handle this one without a text. I do need you to prepare the ground for me, though."
"How so?"
"Do you have any contacts at Al Jazeera?"
Barnes said he did. He had taken Al Jazeera's London bureau chief to lunch a couple times in a futile effort to get the network to stop broadcasting Al-Qaeda propaganda messages.
"Give your friend a call now. Let it leak that I'm about to make an offer to the kidnappers."
"What sort of offer?"
"One they can't refuse."
"Is there something else I should know, Mr. Ambassador?"
"I'm resigning my post, Steve. You can call me Bob."
"Yes, Mr. Ambassador."
Halton hung up the phone, then stood up and headed toward his bedroom to shower and change. He was no longer Ambassador Robert Halton, the desperate and broken American diplomat who had no choice but to watch his daughter die. He was once again Robert Carlyle Halton, multi-billionaire and kingmaker, and he was going to get Elizabeth back, even if it took every penny he had. Chapter 44. Aalborg, Denmark, 12:15 p.m., Friday.
"Your chariot has arrived, Mr. Allon."
Lars Mortensen lifted his hand and pointed toward the heavy gray sky. Gabriel looked up and watched a Gulfstream 5 sinking slowly toward the end of the runway at Aalborg Airport. The slight movement caused his head to begin throbbing again. It had taken 18 sutures, administered by a sleepy Skagen doctor, to close the 3 wounds in his scalp. His face bore a cross-hatched pattern of tiny cuts inflicted by the exploding safety glass of the windshield. Somehow, he had managed to shield his eyes at the instant of detonation, though he had no memory of doing it. He could recall the events of the rest of the evening, however, with faultless clarity. Ordered by the kidnappers to relinquish his telephone in Funen, he had been forced to drive the crippled Audi with its blasted-out windshield 3 miles in order to find a public phone. He had rung Carter and Mortensen from the parking lot of a small market on the outskirts of Skagen, and, in language fit for an insecure line, had told them what had transpired. Then he had driven back to the dunes and watched the cottage burn slowly to the ground. 20 more minutes would elapse before he heard the distant scream of the sirens and saw the first police and firefighters stumble bewildered onto the scene. A uniformed policeman had peppered Gabriel with questions, while an ambulance attendant wiped the blood from his face. "Talk to Lars Mortensen of the PET," was all Gabriel said. "Mortensen will explain everything."
"You're sure about the body count in the cottage?" Gabriel asked Mortensen now.
"You've asked me that 10 times.
Answer it again."
"There were only 3. The 2 terrorists and the old man. No Elizabeth Halton."
Mortensen fell silent as the Gulfstream set down on the runway and flashed past their position with the roar of reversing engines.
"Not exactly the way the story of Abraham and Isaac turned out in the Bible. I still can't quite believe he actually set up his own father to be killed."
"It's the Al-Qaeda version," said Gabriel.
"Murder anyone who dares to oppose you, even your own flesh and blood."
The Gulfstream had reached the end of the runway and was now taxiing back toward their position on the tarmac.
"You'll do your best to keep my role in this affair a secret?" Gabriel asked.
"There's always a chance it could leak out up here. Unfortunately, you came in contact with many people last night, but as far as my service is concerned, you and your team were never here."
Gabriel zipped his leather jacket and extended his hand.
"Then,
It was a pleasure not meeting you.
The pleasure was mine.
Mortensen gave Gabriel's hand an admonitory squeeze.
But the next time you come to Denmark, do me the courtesy of telling me first.
We'll have lunch. Who knows? Maybe we'll actually have something pleasant to talk about.
I suppose anything's possible.
Gabriel climbed out of the car, then peered at Mortensen through the open door.
I nearly forgot something.
What's that? He told him about the Beretta he had been forced to leave at the rest stop on Funen. Mortensen frowned and murmured something in Danish under his breath.
I'm sorry, Gabriel said. It slipped my mind.
I don't suppose you removed the bullets before throwing it into the rubbish bin.
Actually, it was quite loaded.
If I were you, I'd get on that plane before I changed my mind about covering up your hand in this mess.
Gabriel set out across the tarmac toward the Gulf Stream. The air stair had been lowered.
Sarah was leaning against the side of the open doorway, hands in the pockets of her jeans, legs crossed at the ankles.
Carter was seated at the front of the cabin and was deep in conversation on the telephone.
He nodded Gabriel into the opposite seat, then hung up and regarded him speculatively as the plane rose once more into the slate-gray sky.
"Where's my team?" asked Gabriel.
"They slipped quietly out of Copenhagen early this morning. They were understandably vague about their destination. I assume they were headed toward Amsterdam."
"And us?"
"The British have granted us landing rights at London City Airport. I'm going to the embassy to wait out the deadline. You will be escorted to Heathrow, no questions asked. I assume you can find your own way home from there?"
Gabriel nodded slowly.
"Consider yourself fortunate, Gabriel. You get to go home. I get to go to London and face the music for our failure here last night. You're not exactly popular in Washington at the moment. In fact, there are a good many people baying for your blood, the president included. And this time, I'm in the shit with you.
A career free of scandal is not a proper career at all, Adrian."
"Shakespeare?"
"Chemron."
Carter managed a weak smile.
"The office operates by a different set of standards than the agency. You accept the occasional mistake if it occurs in the service of a noble cause. We don't tolerate failure. Failure is not an option."
"If that were the case, they would have turned the lights out at Langley a long time ago."
Carter squinted as a sudden burst of sunlight came slanting through the cabin window. He pulled down the shade and stared at Gabriel for a long moment in silence.
"She wasn't there, Adrian. She was never there. In all likelihood, she's still somewhere in Britain. It was all an elaborate deception orchestrated by the Sphinx. They planted that ferry reservation number on the body of the man I wounded in Hyde Park, and left him in the dunes of Norfolk for the British to find. The Sphinx instructed Ishak to remain in touch with his wife in Copenhagen, knowing that eventually NSA, or someone else, would overhear him and make the connection. And when we did make the connection, the Sphinx played it out slowly, so there would be almost no time left before the deadline. He wants you frustrated and dejected, and tearing yourself to shreds behind the scenes. He wants you to feel you have no choice but to release Sheikh Abdullah."
This is the end of disc number 8. Please continue listening on disc number 9.